Professor Tony Judt is one of our foremost historians. His book, Post-War, on Europe since 1945, is usually described as magisterial, received rave reviews, and is regarded by many as likely to be the definitive work on the subject for decades to come. Growing up chiefly in and around South London, Tony spent much of the swinging 60s on an Israeli kibbutz before going up to Cambridge and becoming a professional academic. He often describes himself as an outsider, of the left but attached to no sectarian isms, a Jew who believes that a single state is the only workable solution to the problems of the Middle East, a Brit now living and working in the United States with a book just out which casts major doubts on the path both his native and adopted countries have taken in the past 30 years or so, and a book written in a hurry, which is the reason that I'm here in Tony Judt's New York apartment, because 18 months ago, Tony was diagnosed with a condition which was to change all assumptions, all plans, and academically turn him into a man in a hurry. Tony Judt, can you explain what happened in your own words?
Yes, indeed, Peter. Thank you for having me on the programme. Well, sometime in the spring of 2008... I noticed that I was starting to make little mistakes on the keyboard, that my fingers were not hitting the right letters, that kind of thing, that opening a bottle of wine with a corkscrew was a bit harder than it used to be and so forth. Didn't think much about it, thought I'm getting older in my 60s. These things happen. And then in the course of that summer, I found that throwing a baseball was getting very hard. I would put a huge amount of effort into it. It would go nowhere. I went eventually to see a doctor, and I was diagnosed with what in this country is called Lou Gehrig's disease. It's known in England as motor neuron disease. The most famous person to have it, I suppose, is Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge physicist. Basically, what it does, over the course of a year or two, in my case, it only took about 8 months, is that all the motor neuron cells that power your muscles, essentially the electricity that fires your muscles, dies. And the muscles, of course, die consequently. And so in the course of less than a year, you go from a perfectly healthy body to a quadriplegic with no movement below your neck. That in my case, very little diaphragm muscle as well, so that I have to have a breathing tube to push the air in and suck it out, which is why I sound slightly breathless as I speak to you.
That is one of the most striking things about what happened to you, was its speed. And I guess, in a strange way, that's worse than something that happened completely suddenly, in the sense that you just have to sit and watch it happen.
Well, it's true. And in fact, I was in a good position to compare, because about 9 years ago I had cancer, which is a fairly conventional disease, of course, in which something happens, there's pain, there's an operation. The thing is either solved or it's not solved. In my case, it was solved. That's that. Whereas with this disease, there's no pain, there's no physical sensation loss, but you simply sit and watch your right fingers, your right arm, your right shoulder, your left arm, your legs, your stomach muscles die bit by bit.
How much were you told about the likely implications of what was happening to you? I mean, did you know the lot? Did they know the lot?
Well, the thing is that neurologists regard themselves as the intellectuals of the medical profession, which means they will talk a lot and tell you nothing. What they tell you is that there is no pattern. Everyone has his own pattern. Statistically, you're going to die within 1 to 3 years, but it could be 6 months to 5 years, or if you're an outlier, 10 years. But they won't tell you any projection at all. All they will tell you is the kinds of things that will happen to you. So you get to sit at home, check on the internet and see, aha, I'm going to be an outlier, or I'll go fast or I'll go slowly.
So an outlier is someone who carries on, because, I mean, the classic example that people will think of is Stephen Hawking, who, of course, is still with us.
Right, but, of course, you see, when you say to a neurologist, What about Stephen Hawking? He's been around 25 years. They say, oh, well, that proves he doesn't have the disease. He's got some other disease. So it doesn't ruin our statistics at all.
How much do you want to know?
I want to know everything. It's a personality trait, I suppose.
Yeah. A historian's trait.
Well, a historian. But also, as you very kindly said, in your introduction, I've always been a bit of an outsider. I look in on things, to want to know about them rather than feel inside them, as it were. And so I look at this disease as something that's happened to me that I can understand. If I understand it, I can't, of course, fix it. But I can feel I've got some control of my life still.
How much did you discuss it with other people? I don't mean so much neurologists, but people close to you, your wife, your friends, because one of the things about you being an outsider is, you know, the impression I get having read your own essays is that you're also someone who's self-sufficient, who perhaps likes to do it yourself.
That's probably true. That's a fair comment. I talked about it a lot with my wife, of course, inevitably. I talked about it to some extent with my children. They're young. I had children late. So I've got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, both boys. They're very willing to talk about it, but like all children, they have a natural cut-off point where they just don't want to think beyond that. And so I have to know where that is and stop there. But I think on the whole, I've found that I'm more comfortable writing about it than talking about it. That's partly because talking is a bit tiring, but it's also because when I'm writing, I'm talking to myself. That when I talk to myself, I've got a good audience who understands what I'm trying to say, rather than having to explain things that don't need explaining.
So was it a difficult decision to agree to talk to me in that case?
Not in the least, for exactly that reason, that I felt that you would probably understand, A, having a handicap yourself, B, having met many people like me, some of whom are useless at talking about themselves, others who may be quite good. So you would understand any idiocies I came up with.
I mean, are there things that you want people to know? You write about it, and I guess as a historian, that gives you the measure of time and consideration to weigh what you're saying. But do you think there are things that are different in talking about it?
I think if you're talking about it, and someone can hear you talking or see you talking or feel the communication, some sense of what the disease does to you comes across. People tell me that when I write, I sound marvellously fluent and myself, and even more myself than I used to be and all that. When they hear me talk, they realise it's quite an effort. For example, I've been told that I'm supposed to consume 3,000 calories a day, even though I don't have a single moving muscle below my neck, because the sheer effort of talking alone consumes as much as a professional runner when you have a body in this condition.
Could you just give a sense of what it's like to actually have that slow process that you described at the beginning? That idea that, in a way, I don't know, that you're being consumed, if
right.
You
like. No, it's consumed isn't put it nicely, because, of course, you don't know which bits the monster will eat next. I think the feeling that you have is that it's bound to stop here. That, you know, it'll never get worse than my being unable to move my arms. Then suddenly the leg stops moving or slows down. More commonly, actually, it's catastrophic. It's a series of shelves. You fine for a bit and you fall down. You think, why did I fall down? The answer, of course, is that your left knee will no longer support you, that it never will again. And so you have to get used to the idea that you're now a person with a defunct left knee. Then you move from that to growing familiarity. Then in the end, what strikes one is how astonishingly malleable we are. You learn to do without a remarkable range of things you thought were intrinsic to your person. And they turn out not to be. There is some intrinsic person inside who is not dependent on these vital external attributes. It's quite interesting.
Is there one thing above all others that you are angriest about of having to do without?
When I think about it, it's my legs. I could do without the arms. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. I could even live, if I had to, on this silly breathing tube. But the legs are what enabled me to move to other places, to travel on trains, to walk up and down old country roads, to feel that I was a person who could be displaced physically as well as mentally. Now to be stuck inside a chair, inside a room, inside a flat, inside one city, with mobility of that kind, far too exhausting to undertake freely. That's, I think, the biggest loss.
I want to come back, if I may, a bit later to some of the strategies that you've used to cope. But could you perhaps tell us a bit more about who you are, where you come from?
I, as you said, was born in London, South London, grew up there. My father was a Belgian immigrant, Jewish immigrant, came to London just before the Second World War. My mother was born in the East End of London, so I grew up a London kid. I got involved in left-wing Jewish Zionist organizations in the 60s. So my version of the 60s was sex, lies, videotape, drugs, and kibbutzim. And I spent some part of the 60s living in the Middle East, became increasingly disillusioned with Israel and Zionism, particularly after the Six-Day War, which I experienced. I went to Cambridge as an undergraduate, and I then went to Paris, studied as a graduate student there, came back to Cambridge, was lucky, got a job, taught in Cambridge, Berkeley in America, Oxford for some years. I've been for the last quarter of a century here in New York City, teaching at New York University. In a nutshell, that's me.
Let's pick out a few of those threads, because in the essays you've written since your disability, you come across as a very self-sufficient, but that's quite a lonely child. There's a lot of wandering around, being on trains, which you clearly loved, being on Green Line buses, but a lot of it on your own.
Oh, Peter, that's very perceptive of you. I never thought of myself as a lonely child, because I never thought of myself as lonely. But I wasn't a lone child, if you see what I mean. It's very solitary. My parents, wonderful people in their own way, they had very little idea of the life I led.
Well, no, that was extraordinary, that you would go off and come back when you were still quite young, at quite late hours of the night, having been on trains and not actually going anywhere and not really having to explain what you'd done.
Well, yeah, they would say things like, where did you go, dear? And I would say, oh, I went to the Science Museum, or I went to Blenheim Palace, or whatever it might be. And they would say, oh, you know, how nice. What's it like? And I would say what I'd read about it. And meanwhile, what I'd really been doing was taking the central line to Ongar or something, just for the sake of it, so I could turn around and come back. I mean, in a way, it was a wonderful childhood.
And what were you doing? I mean, was it curiosity? Because you just seem to have been exploring.
Well, I mean, of course, what I was doing then, and what I think I was doing as I look back now, may be two very different things. What I'm fairly sure I was doing was simply enjoying mobility, enjoying being away, enjoying not having to talk, no offence, but talking was something that I spent my life doing quite well, but actually never liked. And so I enjoyed being alone. I would buy a newspaper deliberately so people wouldn't make conversation with me. And I've never understood people who say, no, it's so great to travel, you meet people. They always think, God, what a failure. You know, that's not why you travel at all. So as a child, I looked a lot. As I think back, I don't think I was a particularly precocious or unusual kid, but I had one attribute that you get from being alone. That is that you see more, you notice more, you hear more, you make more mental notes. I got a huge storehouse of observations. But if people said to me, write a novel about it, they couldn't, because there'd be no conversation. There'd be no exchanges. It would simply be narrative.
And yet, I mean, there is a very compelling irony in a sense that you talk about, you know, not necessarily wanting to communicate all the time, enjoying being alone, and yet one of the aspects of your condition is that you can hardly ever be alone.
That's right. Indeed. You know, when I think about it, you said to me, you know, what is it you miss most? And I said, my legs. That's true, and I would still say that. But the other thing, in a way, they're connected, is solitude. I can never again, you know, have a cup of coffee, read a book, going back to the old days, smoke a cigarette, sort of just be alone, communicating with nothing but silence. Or if I am silent, there's someone else silent sitting next to me. Now, you know, one should say straight away that there are things you do learn about life with this disease, which is that other people can be pretty fantastic. And you don't know that if you don't need them. And when you do need them and you discover who's out there, it's quite something, and I mean that. But, you know, I can't be alone. And I now look back, and I think one of the reasons that I write about it is that solitude is now a condition I can look at rather than experience. So I'm writing about it as an externality, but I'll never have it again myself, it's true.
Which must be quite difficult to stare in the face, because we don't normally know when we're never going to have something.
That's correct. Again. I mean, the funny thing about this disease is that normally in life, we have a pretty good idea of what we'll be doing next week, but no idea at all of where things will be in a few years' time. In my case, it's the reverse. I've no idea where things will be next week. You know, my condition could slip again. I could suddenly, you know, discover that I'm at a whole new level. But I'm pretty clear exactly where I'll be in 3-4 years' time. You know, either dead or like this, but worse. And that's a clarity of knowledge about the future, which is both terrifying and reassuring.
And is that really reassuring?
No, but it beats boredom.
I'd like to go back to the kind of strategies you have to use to deal with your life as it is now. But I think probably what we have to establish, I mean, what kind of things do people have to do for you now? You know, I'm trying to establish your level of dependence.
I'm afraid that's all too easy to explain. I can do nothing for myself. I cannot move, so I can't get up. I can't relieve myself without someone doing it for me in the bathroom or toilet. I have to be obviously moved into a toilet, out of a toilet, off a toilet. To be very precise, I have to be wiped, cleaned, washed, brushed, put in a seat, and rendered functional. Only when I'm sitting and I've been put in a sitting position in a wheelchair with my breathing tube in place and phlegm cleared out of my throat and an assistant sitting next to me and a computer switched on in front of me, do I become a person. At that point, I can talk, think, read, respond, dictate, disagree, be funny, argumentative, and so on. But the minute I get an itch under my arm, I go back to being this vegetable that someone has to lean over, scratch the itch, or I can't function. If I get hungry, I have to be fed, and so on. There is nothing I can do except function through brain and mouth, really.
And with that ability that you've just shown to kind of stare that in the face and express it as clinically as that, how do you deal with that? In other words, how do you reconcile those two people, in a sense, the one who is dependent and the one who is still Tony Judt, the academic, the thinker?
It's because I think I don't quite think of it that way. Right. The way I think of it could probably go something like this. I have a choice. I've been presented with a choice. My choice is to lie here and stare at the ceiling in a semi-vegetative state, very bored, presumably taking drugs to avoid depression and being kept alive, possibly for a long time because this disease is not in itself a killer. You die from secondary consequences, like accidentally aspirating something into your lung or something like that. But if you don't do it, you might live a long time. So your choice is to lie very bored, very vegetative for a very long time, or else to say, sod it, I intend to do something. Well, what can I do? If I'd been a plumber, it would be catastrophic. But the thing I've done well all my life is read, write, talk, think, teach, disagree, explain, and so on. And I can still do those things. So I've made a quite conscious decision about 9 months ago or so that I would do those things as long as I could, even if they shortened my life by tiring me out, which they may do. I don't know if that's true or not, but they may do. And since that decision, I've written the equivalent of 2.5 books, given a public lecture, taught graduate courses, and dictated probably thousands of emails. And I feel good at it, so it works.
So are you really, in a way, saying, I am going to fulfill my potential, what I have to say, what I have to write, I'm going to get that done regardless?
I think probably, though I don't know until I do it, what I have to write. In other words, it's not as though I lay there and thought, geez, Tony, you've got all these things you've got to say, man. Time to get up and say them. I just felt the need to do what I'm able to do. And then it turned out I had quite a few things in me still to say. But actually, if I may, all I've really demonstrated, I think, is that Descartes was right. You know, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. That I'm thinking, and therefore I'm still around.
You've written about nighttime as a period of kind of exquisite torture, more torture than exquisite, I guess. But that is a time when you are forced, in a way, to do a lot of that thinking. Can you just explain what that is like and what you are doing in that time?
Sure. I mean, I'm laid down in my bed or my wheelchair. My arms are put in a particular place. My head's put in a place. Everything is set up. The microphone is there, so I can call for my assistant. And then I've got, whatever it might be, 5-6 hours to kill, so to speak. I will eventually fall asleep because one gets tired. But the mind is racing, so what does it do? The body has got to be switched off. If I've got an itch, tough luck. I can't do anything about it. If I have a bodily need short of something urgent, it's just going to have to wait. So instead, you go into your head. What I've done is set up a series of what I call memory chalets. Now, this is my analogy with memory palaces, which were the Renaissance memory technique, where you remember a set of thoughts by putting them in different rooms in the building, or in drawers, in a cupboard, in a room, in a building. So when you go back to the building in your head, you can go to room by room, open the drawer, and retrieve the thought you had. And that way, when you get good at it, you can actually remember an astonishing body of material in the right sequence. Now, I know nothing about palaces, but I love Swiss chalets. So what I've done is imagine memory chalets. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, I lie there, I go to Zermatt or Murin or Grindelwald or Chamonix or somewhere. I go to my chalet, which is a sort of generic, boring Swiss chalet of the kind I like. I open my door, and on the left, there might be a little ski room, or on the right, there might be a kitchen. And in there will be cupboards or shoe boxes or whatever. Then in each one of these things, I think a thought. The thought goes into that place. Then I go back in the room and I remember what's where. And before I fall asleep, I might have written or sketched out the half of a little essay for the New York Review on the Green Line bus, for example, or on growing up in Southwest London or on what it means to be Jewish food-wise, or on, you know, what Paris was like in 68. And I wake up the next morning, the first thing I do is go back to the chalet, check out the rooms in the same sequence, and I've got the thing in my head, pretty much ready to talk out to my assistant when he comes in and we switch on the computer.
And that works, does it? You can retrieve what you set out in the night.
Well, it's not perfect. There are times when you get the kitchen confused with the toilet, or, you know, which bedroom is which, and the ideas don't flow. But by and large, yes. I mean, I was always gifted, lucky, I guess, with a pretty good memory, pretty good sequential memory, so I could remember ideas in the order I wanted them. And I was good with words, so that this works for me. But the fact is that it's also a way to put myself to sleep. So I fall asleep imagining myself walking it down a little village street in snowy Switzerland in 1956. So I get the pleasure of that, the pleasure of memory, and the functional use value of this list of data. Yeah, it does work. What it works perfectly for is a lecture or a long essay. When you're doing a book, you've got to think of it probably as a series of different chalets for each chapter, and a certain amount of refreshing is required. But then don't forget, there's a lot of reinforcement, because there's every night of the week and every week of the month and every month of the year.
You painted that picture of the night, which is so vivid and perhaps conveys what you're dealing with. I mean, the fact that you're doing this in order to ward off all those things that are kind of disturbing you, all those itches, all those things that people can do without thinking about them at night.
Well, I think that what I'm doing is trying to achieve consciously what the poet Emily Dickinson described poetically, where she writes at one point, she says, "After great pain, a formal feeling comes." And in a way, what the great pain in my case is not physical pain, like cancer. It's the mental pain of knowing the condition I'm in. So what I do is try to move from the great pain of knowledge to the formal feeling of control, the sense that I have got something over this damn disease that it can't get back at me. So in a way, I've achieved a kind of oriental level of mental control without having any idea what I'm doing. I mean, there's nothing mystical or oriental about me. I'm just your rational South London kid. But it works, and so because it works, I do it.
So there is a form of scrapping in it, if you like. You know, when you talk about the South London kid, it's a bit of it's a way of fighting back, is it?
Well, it is, I think. I mean, it's a feeling that this bloody disease, which is viciously consuming, like a kind of octopus that eats you little bit by bit. You can't cure it, you can't fix it, you can't stop it, but you've got one thing over it. It doesn't hurt. So if you're tough-minded, you don't need medicine, you just need a mind. Every day I think, thank God that I got this disease, so to speak, as someone who lives by his mind. Because if I lived by some marvellous physical skill, I would have been screwed.
And yet I read that you could get pretty irritated by people who suggested that because you lived by the mind, that, you know, actually things could have been a lot worse.
Oh, that's garbage. I mean, yeah, things couldn't be any worse for me, except if I'd been someone else, but then it wouldn't be me. So from my point of view, it's as bad as it gets. But I'm aware that if I'd been someone else, it would have been worse. That doesn't make it satisfactory. It's like saying, but people who say to me, you know, well, the great thing about a physical disability is that you develop other skills. They think, well, no doubt that's actually true, but that couldn't possibly be grounds for having the disability. That's just a side benefit. The benefit is the wrong word in any case. I think I understand people's desire to say that, because people don't quite know what to say to you. They'll say, my God, you've got ALS, motor neuron disease. What should I say? I'm so sorry. So they'll say, oh, well, Tony, the least you can write. So rather than say, don't be ridiculous, I say yes.
Disability politics has encouraged us to see disability as having many positive aspects and almost the idea to wear it with pride. I wonder if that kind of idea has any resonance with you.
No one will convince me to use words like otherwise abled or alternatively abled. Disability is disability. We should call a spade. But that said, obviously, if you are a thinking person with a disability, you will try, you know, to turn it to some use, to some lesson, to some purpose, to some objective value, rather than just lie there and say, I'm disabled. You know, there's nothing I can do about it, that I want pity and help. You want to say, I have capacity. But you don't want people to say, ah, yes, you have a special skill, thanks to the fact that you can't do something. I don't think I'll ever see that. What I see is that, okay, I have motor neuron disease. I'm showing that it's possible with motor neuron disease to think, talk, live, be useful, and so on. But surely anyone could see that would have been true. What kind of insensibility would it take to say, because you have a disability, you're a lesser person?
And yet people do think that and say that. Well, certainly think it.
I think they think it. I give you that. And in that case, I regard that as roughly analogous with racism. You simply turn around and say, don't be ridiculous. The fact that I'm black, green, blue, yellow, female, gay, whatever, doesn't make me a better person, doesn't make me differently skilled. Just a person like you. Stuff it.
Your experience in the last 18 months has obviously made you think quite deeply about what is a life, what is your life, what's it for. Are you forced to ask yourself how you define what is a life worth living? The big philosopher's question, I guess.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that. I can only give you small answers. We can't live for a purpose unless we are saintly people. We live the life we live. It's imperfect. It's full of failure and success, shortcomings, mistakes, and so on. But I have one big advantage over the rest of you. I know I'm going to die soon, but I'm going to die in a very good mental state. So I know I'm in a position to look at my life in the round, whereas most people don't do that because they don't expect to die in the immediate future. So what I can tell you about my life is that I can now think of how to give it a shape, the shape I want to give it, that the shape I think good life, a well-lived life should have, is one that has some use value to people after yourself. I don't believe in the afterlife, but I do believe that we have a moral responsibility to people who come after us, and that we are, in a sense, part of our own future by virtue of what we leave behind. The one I want to leave behind is a sense of sort of moral engagement, individual choices, and examples that my kids don't have to follow, but they can look to and say, that's the kind of thing we should do. If I do that, that's a well-lived life for me.
Are you able to share that kind of idea with the people who love you, who must, you know, your wife, your children, who must be also staring in the face what you're staring in the face? Are you able to talk about that, exchange views on that?
It's funny, you can't do it head on. It's like sending a rocket to the moon. If you point the rocket at the moon, it'll miss because the moon will have moved by the time it gets there. You've got to aim off, if you see what I mean. So when I talk to my kids, I don't talk about, you know, why do I live? What kind of life have I lived? what's the point of it? What lesson do I want you to take away? I mean, the poor kids would just, well, firstly, they'd walk out of the room, and quite rightly too. Then secondly, they couldn't handle it. So I talk about baseball instead. But I want to leave a kind of example, an example of moral seriousness, of fun, of dissent, of individual choice that you don't have to accept other people's word for, so that without quite making it the subject of conversation, they feel that that's who their dad is. And that will make it much easier for them afterwards to look back and say, yes, I now know what he was doing. I know who I was talking to. With my wife, it's a bit different, obviously. There, we spend most of the time, if we're not arguing about this, that, or the other in the usual way, talking about future plans. But, you know, no one wants to leave behind a life that consisted of working out what to do with the bank accounts. So I try every now and then to talk about other stuff. But it's hard, because it's easy for me to say after my death, because I won't be there to live it. But my wife will, so I prefer not to talk about it much, because I can see it makes her very unhappy. So in a funny kind of way, to spare other people's feelings, I don't talk about my own death.
I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, there is this major debate going on now, certainly in Britain, certainly in the United States, about euthanasia, about assisted suicide. Do you take a view on that, and has your situation had an effect on that view?
I don't believe that my situation has affected my views, partly because my views were pretty clear, I think, before. Don't seem to have changed. My view on the euthanasia question is, firstly, I do understand the complexities. It's not as easy as people on either side sometimes want to express it to be. My view is this. There's a crucial distinction between killing and letting die. And in the case of a mortal disease like mine, merely letting someone die is actually quite acceptable to the medical profession and to many other people. Thus, all I have to say is, for example, if I stupidly swallow something the wrong way, which can easily happen because of the lack of breath, I don't want to be revived. The reason I don't want to be revived is because I would have to be revived with a tracheotomy or something. Therefore, I wouldn't be able to speak. If I can't speak, I can't communicate. If I can't communicate, I'm not me.
That's the bottom line,
isn't it? That's it for me. Because I don't want to be the vegetable in the corner, smiling sweetly at life going on, sucking the energy out of the room, and being angry and frustrated that I can't take part. I think my wife understands that. We've talked a lot about it. All she would have to do is not actively intervene, and then I would die, as it were, from the consequences of the disease. I see that as acceptable. The problem comes when there's a question of active intervention. And on that, while I would myself be in favour of participatory euthanasia, I don't feel authorised to impose that burden on others, because I see that as a burden that each individual would have to choose for themselves.
So would that mean then that the law, certainly as it stands in Britain, in a way you wouldn't see any great reason to change it?
No, but that's unique to my own condition, because there are many people who could not die of their own volition, so to speak, or by accident, but would be in great pain and would wish to be put out of their misery. And in my case, I would want a law that allowed me to help someone die if they needed to. But I could understand the problem facing many other people who see that as too great a moral burden for most people to be competent to bear. I understand that objection, I really do. I don't share it, but I appreciate it.
When you were writing about the night and coping with it, one of the things that you said was what you would really like would be for someone to be there who you could talk to, who you could talk to without feeling you were imposing on them and keeping them awake when they ought to be sleeping, and with whom you could obviously have a broad exchange of ideas. I wanted to ask you if you had a kind of completely broad canvas and could select anyone, living or dead, have you ever thought about who you might want to summon to have that conversation with?
Gosh. Well, bear in mind that we are all, me included, complicated, imperfect human beings. So sometimes I want to commune with the brain of Baruch Spinoza. Sometimes I want to commune with the body of Hedy Lamarr. And unfortunately, they tend to come in separate parts. I think the short answer is that if I had to choose, I would like to be able to talk occasionally to Spinoza, occasionally perhaps to one of the smarter of the ancient Greeks, but walk him through our present world and hear what he thinks about it. Occasionally, I would simply settle for Hedy Lamarr or her modern equivalent. I mean, I'm a variable guy, and I'm not just the brain. But I think, crucially, what I would want is someone, I don't know the answer to this, sadly, who was well known for liking silence. In other words, I would like to be able to have a conversation with someone who knew when to shut up.
That seems a good place to stop. Tony Jutt, thank you very much indeed.
Peter, thank you so much.
No Triumph, No Tragedy was presented by Peter White, and the producer was Cheryl Gabriel.